Moral Police Department, and this must be Mr. Capozzi?
Tony Capozzi.
Capozzi?
From Fresno, California.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. Mayor Police Department.
Oh, you're here from Fresno?
Yes.
Very nice place, Fresno.
It is very nice.
I always have very pleasant visits there.
I know.
Please proceed.
Thank you. As this court knows, this is a conspiracy to commit the securities, mail and wire fraud, and money laundering case. The entire defense in this case was the defendant's lack of intent to defraud and good faith belief that there was measurable quantities or measurable and economically viable quantities of precious metals and volcanic cinders. Now, the government put on one expert, Dr. Prey, testified that there was not any kind of measurable quantities of precious metals. And he admitted assays for the truth of the matter asserted that there wasn't any precious metals in these cinders. Yet the defense was not allowed to introduce evidence that established the defendant's good faith belief that there was precious metals in these volcanic cinders. The main issue in this case, it really doesn't come down as to whether or not there actually was precious metals, but as to only the good faith belief and what was in the mind of the appellant in this particular case. A co-conspirator was on the stand, Michael Gardner. He identified Exhibit 509 and 510, which were assays. There were two exhibits and they're about two pages each that was allowed into evidence. He was shown the exhibits. He said, yes, I saw these, I looked at these, and I examined them and conversed with the defendant, now the appellant in the case. They were admitted, and the judge specifically told the jury, these are admitted not for the truth of the matter asserted. We don't know how truthful these are, but it only goes to show the state of mind of the defendant. After those two were put in, the defense then attempted to put in exhibits 509, or 501 and 512, which is, as you can see, a stack of assays that had been conducted just as the others had. The court saw how voluminous these exhibits were and said, oh, wait a minute, I can't let this in. There's too much there. There's too much evidence there. Well, the government made the same objection that it's not allowed because there's no foundation laid. The defense made the same argument they did on the other two exhibits that it's not for the truth of the matter, Your Honor. It's only to show the defendant's state of mind.
And
in fact,
the problem is that without leaving aside any scientific validity, which it seems to me is not right, that there's not really a Daubert problem here, but in order to tell you anything even about the defendant's state of mind, don't you have to know something about what about the particular sample that was used for each of these assays and where it came from? You don't know what was being assayed, it doesn't tell you anything about her state of mind.
It does. These assays did say what was assayed.
It said where it came from and
not no. That's a good question. It didn't necessarily say it came directly from these areas that were being mined, but I don't think that's the issue. The issue here is what did these assays say?
But she could have adulterated every one of them before she gave them to the assayer, or other people could have.
She could have, but there was no evidence she did.
But there's no evidence she didn't. That's why you need a foundation in order to know what these documents are.
If you're putting it in,
each of those assays says, that recites down at the bottom that the assayer can't verify where the samples came from.
And one of them, it did. Dr. Jordan's, I think it was. I think that was on 512. But on 501, that's not the case. It was from Geochemical, which was the government's witness acknowledged it was a very credible assayist. The point is,
he's an incredible assayist, but he was only assaying whatever he was given. And unless there's a foundation as to what he was given, I don't see that those documents themselves on their face have any significance at all.
I think they have deep significance in terms of the defendant's state of mind. Your argument is correct in terms of the foundation. There's no question that the foundation wasn't laid as to where it came from, how it was done, etc. But that's not the point here. The point here
but
is
that she was in a position to know that. And therefore, many of the samples were brought by her.
I disagree with that, but go ahead.
Well, I looked at them, and many of them said they were brought by her.
Well, if you looked, I went through them with her last week over at Dublin.
Well, some of them were, okay? Many of them, but a significant number of them were.
Some were submitted by her, yes. And some
others were brought by other people, but she was a principal in the company. So,
she was. But that's the government's argument in this case. Everything in this case by the government is it's a scheme. No matter what the appellant did in this game, in this scheme.
That's not the question. The question is what would the jury, what good would this have done to the jury in terms of understanding her state of mind without some evidence about the background of these samples?
I don't think you need the background of the samples because whether or not these are true or false is not the significant aspect. That's irrelevant. What's irrelevant, what's relevant is what was in her mind. Mr. Gardner said he reviewed these. Indeed, his handwriting is on these. Her handwriting are on these. They reviewed these, and yet they weren't allowed to testify as to what they talked about with this and what was in her mind when she went through this.
If she brings in false samples or adulterated samples, and then she gets a report out that says, oh, yeah, this are very rich in these, then it doesn't change her mind about what the thing is. She knows that the report is going to say that because she salted the sample with these minerals.
I can't disagree with you there, but that's not the case.
So why isn't Judge Berzon's question right on target that without a foundation to show that these were either provided by somebody else or that it's provided by her, she took it right from the ground, that it couldn't have any effect on the state of mind.
Because to set that foundation, that you would need that if it were put in for the truth of the matter asserted. This is an exception to the hearsay rule.
No, you're just wrong about that.
Okay.
Maybe you should go on to the question about the psychiatric test.
Well, that clearly...
Did your client testify?
No, she did not.
And nobody else testified about how these samples got to the assayers, or whatever they're called.
I wasn't the trial attorney. I don't recall any testimony other than it came from Mr. Weinberger and some came from the appellant.
Okay. Go ahead.
Anyway, what I wanted to do is, if I could make one quick argument on this, is on the Moran case. I think in that case, it's just a direct point with this one, where the court didn't allow in the hearsay testimony that went to the state of mind. And another case that just came out also was the district court case. I know it's a district court case, but that's the Messer case where a medical report was allowed to come in, and the court there said that it's allowed in as an exception to the hearsay rule. To go to the psychiatrist testimony, I think that was very important in this particular case. It was brought in afterwards by not the trial counsel, another counsel that had been brought in, and in there, they indicated the problems with the appellant. She is from Taiwan. I got to know her quite well when I did the sentencing and now the appeal. Very difficult to understand her. Very difficult for her understanding the English language. And in their reports, it pointed out the...
Was there a translator present at these proceedings?
I don't think there was. Okay. I know when I went in on the sentencing, there was not. No, there was not.
But we could have had a translator.
Yes. Yes.
So the problem really isn't translation, is it?
I think it's her understanding of what was going on.
Okay, but if the understanding is related to her ability to understand the English language, then the problem is not having a translator, and that's not...
I agree with you.
That's not really something that you can come in and complain about at this point.
I'm not doing that.
Okay? I didn't understand that to be the problem, no. The central problem of the psychiatrist testimony.
Psychiatrist testimony went into and did some testing with her and how she understands and comprehends the English language. They talked about some problems she has in terms of comprehending and understanding certain matters. A lot of these were legal concepts she did not understand.
And she didn't understand them because?
Of her background.
Her background, meaning that she's from Taiwan and doesn't speak English?
She speaks English very, very, not very well.
Again, counsel, if the problem is she didn't understand the English language, that's not the district court's fault if nobody's asked for a translator.
She understands the English language, Your Honor. We're not saying that.
Okay, so the problem is that when you say her background, you don't mean the fact that English isn't her first language. So what is it in her background other than that English isn't her first language that is a problem?
Her understanding involved in this business, understanding what was really going on.
Okay, is it because she's retarded?
She's not retarded.
Okay, I thought, what does the IQ of 79 and borderline mean? I guess I don't understand what those terms are.
Well, 70, I think, is considered retarded. Anything above goes up the ladder, but she's not retarded. I think it's her understanding and her background and her being brought up in Taiwan and following her husband, following others and getting things done, doing what her husband told her. Her husband had passed away, and he, I don't think there's any question that came out through the trial, he was a con man. He had convinced her that what they were doing was fine, and she believed what was going on.
Was any of the money recovered?
I'm sorry?
Was any of the money recovered?
Money had been returned to some of the investors, not all the money, no. No.
What happened to the money?
It was used, it was about $5.2 or $6 million raised, $4.8 million went into building the refinery and doing the mining of the ore and trying to bring out the precious metals. $4.8 million was spent just on doing that. And the other part was doing on various expenses with the business. And the point is, if this was a fraud, why in the world would you spend $4.8 million building a refinery? And I think that was strong evidence that it wasn't a fraud.
I still don't understand your theory as to what the problem is here. You're asking for a new trial.
Yes.
You're asking for a new trial on the basis that you have newly discovered evidence, which is that she is incapable of what? Of understanding the proceedings, and nobody noticed this before? Her previous attorney, taking her all the way through trial, didn't notice that she was having trouble?
I don't think the attorney who tried the case paid very much attention to her.
Relatedly, was the point of the new trial request, it was a new trial request, it was not a request for a competency hearing. Right?
No, it was not.
Right. So, presumably, it's because you would have put this evidence on at trial. You would have put the psychiatric, the new evidence, whoever was doing it, right? It's new evidence, meaning evidence that should have been put on at trial.
I agree.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I would have put it on.
Right. So it doesn't go to competency, because if she's incompetent, she's incompetent.
I'm not saying that.
Right. It must have had to go to some issue at the trial, presumably the intent issue. Right?
Yes, yes.
So it's not a competency question.
Right.
It's an intent question as to whether she was capable of forming the requisite intent.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right. I guess there are two issues that are raised. A, was this, in fact, newly discovered evidence
yes.
with regard to due diligence?
It's an issue, yes, I agree.
And the second is, what was the district judge's reason for not letting it in? And was it an adequate reason?
In looking at the transcript from the motion for new trial, and again, I wasn't part of that, but it was clear he just looked at the affidavits that came in and their reports of their examination of the appellant, and just said, it's preposterous. I don't believe what they say here. I've read other cases. The government, in their response, opposition to the motion for new trial, submitted a number of cases with these experts that testified, and the judge went through those cases and adopted what the government had argued and said, their testimony in these other cases is preposterous. I'm just not gonna believe them, they're not credible. Why did the defendant go look for someone not here in Las Vegas, where we have competent psychiatrists, and go to New York to bring people in from there? I just don't
believe. Well, that doesn't sound like a very good reason. Was there any other reason?
That's the reason, Your Honor.
What about the due diligence question?
In terms of not realizing that, that I don't understand why the defense didn't. It's clear in my experience with this.
It does seem awfully odd to say that, I mean, whatever her psychological situation, no one's claiming that she was mentally ill.
She wasn't. Right? No, she wasn't.
So they're claiming simply that she was, she was a naive and not very bright person.
And agreeing, well, here's the problem with her. She would agree with everything and just go along with everything, not knowing what anybody was talking about.
Do you have any case which would demonstrate that evidence would have been admissible at trial on the intent issue?
Well, I think her mental status would have been admissible at the trial. I'm positive of that fact. I've done it many times in many other trials, showing the state of mind of the person.
And their psychiatrists and psychologists aren't to say this person's not very smart.
I don't say it exactly that way, just to say what their mental capacity is and their understanding of certain issues. And it was pretty clear in the test that she took, she really didn't understand a lot of the things in the test that they were giving her. In dealing with her on the sentencing, I can vouch for the fact.
But counsel, there was also quite a bit of evidence here that, mm-hmm. that she had pretty substantial involvement with this company. She was
no question.
She was made an officer of the company. She met with investors. She met with assets outside the presence of her husband.
True.
She was running these operations. She had previously run other businesses.
It appears that way, but in this, I wish she would have testified so the jury could see what kind of person she really was. She makes like she understands what is really happening and doesn't, and has no clue, and just wants to be a successful business person and did the things she thought she had to do to make this a successful business. And I think that testimony, her being on a stand, her with the psychiatrist examining what her background and explaining to the jury what she's really like.
It sounds to me like what you really have here is an ineffective assistance.
There's no question about that, Your Honor.
And the question is, it wasn't an abuse of discretion not to order the new trial as opposed to filing a 2255, tomorrow and dealing with it that way.
I would never do that and skip an appeal. I would always do the appeal.
I understand.
Then do the 2255.
But you need to tell us why this would be, given the fact that she, presented whatever she presented, mm-hmm. and her lawyer should have been able to evaluate it, which is really what you're saying, and didn't, then we have a due diligence problem, at least on behalf of the lawyers.
I understand that. But I think I lost my train of thought because I had a good answer to what you were just saying. The motion for new trial, here's my issue. The judge may denied it without really hearing any evidence. He should have listened to these psychiatrists. Let me put the defendant on the stand. Well, again, I wasn't there then. Let me put her on the stand on this motion for new trial. And when I went in for sentencing, I told the court, I would like to have the defendant testify so you can really see what her understanding is and the question and answer.
Didn't you also essentially say you didn't believe the psychiatrist either?
Pardon me, that I would
put...
Did
you also suggest that you didn't much believe the psychiatrist either?
Only to the fact that she's retarded. She's not retarded. And I think the problem with the tests that were given by the psychiatrist is that they were given in English. Mm-hmm. I think if they were given in her own native language, it would be a lot different.
Mm-hmm. And, you have about 2 minutes left. You want
yeah,
to
I know. I'd like to reserve it. Let me just make one other point, if I could. On the sentencing, I think the court should have had some kind of a hearing on this. If there's anything, there might be a little bit of sentencing entrapment here because everything was done at the end of 2001. In January 2002, the government sends in two informants to talk to her and talks about possible further investments, et cetera. Nothing ever happened. Everything that took place happened by the end of 2001. And my argument is the guideline edition of 2000 should have been applied. Not the 2001 edition, which would have substantially lessened her sentence.
That would have made a big difference?
Yes, a big difference.
But with non-binding guidelines, it becomes a little hard to get too excited about.
Well, it would have made a big difference at your starting point here. Mm-hmm. Major difference. And I'll get into that in a little. Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Timothy Vasquez. I'm assistant U.S. attorney here in this district, and I was also the trial attorney in this case. And in light of some of the court's questions to appellant counsel, what I'd like to do this morning is just spend a few minutes reviewing the history of this case and the overall scheme, because I think that has a bearing both on the issue he's identified with regard to the assays, and it also is significant in understanding the evidence, or the claim newly discovered evidence, of some sort of, I'm not sure if it's a mental defect, or exactly what they're claiming at this point in time. In any case, this scheme was replete with fraud from beginning to end and from top to bottom. This scheme began back in the early 1990s when Robert F. Flaherty, who's deceased, the appellant's prior husband, began selling ore purchase agreements to investors. Under these ore purchase agreements, he claimed a remarkable ability to turn volcanic cinders into gold. Now, he wasn't the first person to ever make such a representation or suggestion.
It goes back to the Middle Ages.
It goes back a long time, and you can go back to Flagstaff in the 1980s, and then in the 1990s, a fellow named Alvin Johnson was doing some research. Robert Flaherty became familiar with that research. He is, I believe, is beyond dispute right now, simply nothing but a con man. He took that research, packaged it up with his ore purchase agreements, and then went out and found investors persuading them cinders contain huge amounts of precious metals, a wonder ore, potpourri of metals, gold, platinum group metals, just remarkable ore. Then he also claimed that he owned huge reserves of cinders. Figures went as high as $25 billion as this conspiracy progressed. And then he claimed that he had developed, with the assistance of various other people who he credit, the ability to extract the precious metals from the cinders.
But then he up and died.
He died many, many years later.
So it's, you know, much as you'd like to...
Long before he died, in 1992, the appellant married Robert F. Flaherty. There was testimony at trial from a fellow named Don Manzo, who had taken Robert Flaherty literally into his house because he was broke. He was simply peddling these ore purchase agreements and living hand to fist. He meets Diana Flaherty, who at that point in time is working essentially as a mortgage broker or arranging loans through the Far East National Bank, and I'll come back to that in a moment. But he meets her, they get married, and Don Manzo's testimony was after they got married, Diana Flaherty insisted that she have managerial control of the corporation. Manzo's testimony, there were heated arguments, and both of them would consult with him, they'd sometimes argue in front of him, and eventually Robert F. Flaherty capitulated, and he made Diana F. Flaherty an officer in the corporation. In fact, they named that prior corporation, originally called Robert F. Flaherty Incorporated, they changed the name to Robert F. and Diana Lee Flaherty Incorporated. And
I noticed that a number of the victims here, a number of the investors, appeared to come out of the Chinese American community. Were those arranged by Diana Flaherty?
Yes, they were, and that came later in the process. Because
were
earlier,
people she'd been a loan broker for in her previous life?
No, sir. Well, let me just quickly go through sort of the chronology, because the ore purchase agreements, there was some testimony that she participated in selling those ore purchase agreements, and it was beyond any dispute. In fact, there were ledgers in evidence that she was the one managing the funds. She kept a ledger, she'd make the payments to the agents who were selling the ore purchase agreements for them, and she'd also make payments for a variety of personal expenses out of the corporate funds that had been earmarked for this purpose. Now, you go forward a few years, and ore purchase agreements have certain limitations. It's not very efficient. So in 1993, shortly after the appellant married Robert F. Flaherty, the two of them get the idea of going public. What they did was they did a reverse merger with a publicly traded corporate shell. And in that, it was a remarkable reverse merger, because in exchange for controlling interest in this corporation that was later renamed Phoenix Metals, they represented that they were transferring Robert F. Flaherty's secret process, his technology, as to how to extract cinders or gold from cinders. And they also promised to transfer $75 million worth of cinders into the corporation. This was just a corporate shell that had failed. There was testimony by Lee Payne at trial about that. The wrinkle here is, by this point in time, by the psychiatric reports themselves, Diana Flaherty knew Robert Flaherty was nothing but a con man. But yet she signed an affidavit supporting that reverse merger, where he purported to transfer his proprietary processes. What's more, that ore, they didn't own it. There was a brief period of time through a variety of mechanizations that I won't get into right now, from November 94 to about December 95, where they had some sort of colorful title to these cinders, but they were actually owned by Shorty Reedhead. And Robert Flaherty entered into several contracts with Reedhead. Reedhead was upside down to another bank. Robert F. Flaherty came in and said, I'm the world's richest man, I'm going to bail you out, and we're going to make a partnership, and we're going to do something with this. Nothing ever happened. He defaulted on every contract, which is why Shorty Reedhead had to refinance with Far East National Bank. Diana Flaherty knew that. She knew that Reedhead had refinanced the property. She knew Reedhead kept the property because she even got a finder's fee as part of that mortgage from Far East National Bank of about $20,000. Because that's what she was doing at the time. This woman, who is supposed to be mentally incapable in some degree, was working after she left her first husband, who she was married to her first husband in the Midwest, an Air Force officer. She'd had various businesses. She left him because in the psychiatric report, I think they say she considered him a wet blanket or something. He was suppressing her creative impulses. She left him and moved by herself to Los Angeles, where she starts doing this business of mortgage brokering and finding lenders and reviewing property for Far East National Bank. And that's how she met Robert Flaherty in 93. Now, then they do this reverse merger, where she's making representations in an affidavit that she knows are not true. It doesn't matter whether her IQ is 80 or 180. The fact is that she knew, and she said in various prior testimony that was introduced to the court at the time of these other motions, she testified that the land belonged to Shorty Reedhead and that they weren't actually producing any precious metals. And this was a critical part of this whole component. Once they had the corporation, Diana Flaherty was an officer. Throughout the existence of Phoenix Metals, she was an officer, and the testimony from insiders was she was actively managing the corporation. She controlled it. She was the teeth in this Clarity Incorporated in Phoenix Metal, and you didn't want to cross her, was the testimony. But in any case, one of the first things they do after they acquire the corporation, notwithstanding that they've already purportedly transferred $75 million of ore into the corporation, they start pumping it up with more ore. September 28, 1993, minutes signed by Dana Flaherty purport to transfer additional 150,000 tons of ore into the corporation with a value of $150 million. January 25, 1994, Exhibit 46A at trial, an additional 150,000 tons of ore were purportedly transferred.
I mean, all of this goes to your, what, basically what you said in the briefs, which is that the any lies connected to the content of the ore was only a part of it.
Yes, sir. I'm sorry. Yes, Your Honor. And then, of course, the big one was the almost $3 billion that they created. So they create this corporation, and then they proceed to sell the stock. With that, then, let me just move ahead then to
what do you make of the fact that most of the money was used to actually mine this ore?
That's factually untrue. At trial, they call, I believe it was Mr. Olson, to testify as their financial analyst. On cross-examination, I demonstrated that what he was treating as business expenses included tuition for her daughter at Northwestern University and a variety of other matters. On cross-examination, it became clear that he simply took the data that was provided to him by defense counsel and shuffled through that very carelessly, including, and he contradicted himself on this point and was impeached on it, including various personal expenses as business expenses. What the record shows, and we've used a very conservative estimate, because our financial analyst, even though this company wasn't making widgets, even though the Flahertys had no legitimate income that we could identify, we didn't include all the income that went into their various corporate accounts. Rather, he only included income that could be linked to a stock transfer certificate. That is, you have a deposit for, say, $50,000. If that couldn't be linked to a stock transfer certificate, it wasn't included. If it could be linked, that is, if you have a check in the bank records, $50,000 from Joe Smith, and you find a stock transfer certificate in that approximate time frame to Joe Smith, then that was included. So it's a very conservative calculation, and we still came to a figure approaching $6 million. Now, what happened to the money? When this started, Diana Flaherty was working as a mortgage broker living in an apartment in Alhambra, California. Robert F. Flaherty was flat broke, living with Don Manzo. After they got married, Don Manzo testified that he had to pay their telephone bills. He provided a rental car because they couldn't afford one on their own. By the end of the scheme, they're living in a luxury house in the lakes here in Las Vegas, worth over $1 million at the time. I think it was $1.5 million was the purchase price, and who knows what now, which incidentally she put in the name of her nephew, who's an officer in the Taiwanese Air Force, which gets us back down the road towards money laundering. But in addition to the house, from going from borrowing a car from Dan Manzo, the records, the payments from these corporate funds are replete with payments to Jaguar Leasing. They buy a Rolls Royce. I think when she was arrested, she was driving a late model Mercedes. That's where the money went. Yeah, they spent some of this on this refinery down in Searchlight that they had to do once the SEC started coming knocking, asking, where's your refinery? They didn't have any at that time, so they scrambled, put one together. After they went into the consent injunction with the SEC, they have this refinery that they put hundreds of thousands of dollars into, and that's when they spin up and redouble their efforts to pump and dump the stock. But
what about the psychiatric testimony? In particular, it seemed to me quite inappropriate, actually, for the district court to place the amount of stress that it did on his assessment of what he thought of these actual experts because of their, although they have quite impressive resumes, because of their prior testimony for dependents in other cases. So if we thought that was inappropriate, what do we do next?
I have several other arguments in addition to the
well, I understand the, that, the but I'm saying that appears to be what the judge was relying on primarily. Is that not true? In refusing the new trial.
That was prominent among, at least in what is an oral announcement.
What do we
was
do
off
with
the bench.
That if we're applying an abuse of discretion standard, and we think at least what he said most and most vigorously perhaps was an abuse of discretion?
I think what we do with it is we look at it and we apply the law. And the law is that this new evidence would have to have likelihood of changing the results of trial. Now let's look at this new evidence. I'm not exactly sure what it is, because And I quote, and let me correct something. It's actually at page 60 of the sentencing hearing transcript. Appellant counsel, previously defense counsel, said she's not retarded. That just doesn't exist. The problem is language barriers. And taking some kind of test in the English language, if they were done in Chinese or Taiwanese, she would do very well. But I think that's the problem in this particular case. That's what happened here. And that was one of my fundamental arguments with regard to the psychological tests, that they weren't reliable. You're testing somebody from Taiwan based on an English language test with English language cultural references. So in terms of the reliability and admissibility of that evidence at a new trial, it wouldn't come in, because counsel himself has conceded that those tests were flawed because of the English language. Now, was it a mystery to anybody that the defendant's original language is Mandarin? It wasn't. If you go back through the record of trial and the transcripts, that was one of the theories that was raised again and again by defense counsel, pointing to the empty chair of Robert Flaherty, saying that this is a poor housewife, Taiwanese housewife, that isn't fluent in the English language. That was well known. That was developed to the extent it was without her testifying at trial.
I guess my question is, what is the standard here, or what is the appropriate way to proceed? Obviously, the district court judge was really weighing the evidence, deciding that it was not believable evidence for a number of reasons. One was that he just didn't believe these people in general. Another was that he'd observed herself. Another reason was that the language issue. But still, all of these amount to weighing the evidence. Now, is that without having held a hearing, is that a legitimate way to proceed with regard to new evidence?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it is under the established precedent of this circuit. And in our brief, we cite to the case of United States versus Nace, in which the court, and I read, appellates are incorrect in their assertion that the trial court should have held a hearing on their motion. The decision on whether to hold a hearing or to proceed by affidavit is within the sound discretion of the trial court. In this case, the district court had affidavits and full reports from the psychologist and psychiatrist. While I was denied the opportunity to cross-examine them, which I would have welcomed and relished, he had affidavits saying this is how I would have testified. So although he didn't hold a complete evidentiary hearing, he had all the information in front of him. And so I think he was well equipped at
and
that point in time.
And he essentially decided that he himself, not the jury, but wouldn't believe it, and maybe you could say that he also said that he didn't think the jury would believe it, but he didn't. The one thing he didn't say, surprisingly enough, was that this wasn't newly discovered evidence. He didn't say that there wasn't due diligence or whatever.
Well, at the time, counsel were insisting that Ms. Flaherty was borderline mentally retarded. And in her, I don't know if it was 55 years or whatever, how long she'd lived, nobody had ever made that suggestion before. At trial, you had insider testimony.
But at any rate, am I right that wasn't a reason he gave, the district court?
I believe you're correct. At least that wasn't the gravamen of it.
Well, he does say at the end, the defendant has failed to demonstrate that newly discovered evidence is reliable, could not have been discovered previously, so maybe that is a diligence issue, and would have resulted in an acquittal. Go ahead, Constance.
And I'm not sure, but if you look at this, again, what are we to do with it today? Well, what is this newly discovered evidence?
Your position is that the district court looked at the evidence. Well, I don't want to put words in your mouth, so if I'm wrong about this, say no. But is your position that district court looked at it, accepted all these affidavits, and said, even if all this evidence come in the jury had seen it and believed it, wouldn't have made any difference in the verdict. Is that what the district court
did? In part, but I think it also went to the reliability of the evidence under Daubert. And he was finding that the evidence wouldn't have been admissible at trial in any case because he didn't feel that it was reliable. And I believe in light of counsel's concessions that she wasn't mentally retarded in place near, rather this was a problem with using a English language and American-oriented test for a Mandarin-speaking native of Taiwan. I think that shows us or corroborates that, in fact, this would not be reliable and wouldn't be admissible at a new trial.
Can the judge make a Daubert ruling without a Daubert hearing?
I think in the context of a motion for a new trial, it was appropriate for him to look at this and decide whether or not the evidence indicates a new trial would probably result in an acquittal, which is one of the prongs that the appellant would have to show. And he found that they didn't show that, in part because the evidence wasn't reliable.
See, that's what I thought I said, and you said, no, that's not quite right. That he looked at it, he said, if we put this before the jury would not have changed its mind. You came back and he said, but no, he was also saying some of the stuff he would not have let the jury even hear. Which led to my question, but can he make a Daubert exclusion ruling without having a Daubert hearing? Could he make that kind of determination about the reliability of the Daubert reliability determination without having a hearing?
With having a the hearing we had
a Daubert hearing.
Yes, sir, because I believe that the district court had the full panoply of the evidence before him to be able to make that assessment. What's more, I think you're also correct that the district court did find, based upon the evidence of trial, because the evidence, again, the insider testimony and testimony from Mandarin speakers,
well,
Mandarin speaking
well,
victims.
Let me just correct, it's been a long time since I've dealt with Daubert, but Daubert hearing, you actually have to have people come in and say, this is the kind of evidence as to which you can have an expert opinion, and they're basing it on scientific evidence and so on, and there might be disputes of that. But you actually have to have a hearing on that, right?
Your Honor, the expert opinions and the basis for them was well documented in the record. In fact, the reason the experts didn't appear wasn't at my insistence, rather it was the defense request because the experts weren't available. So therefore, they proceeded with affidavits in lieu of the live testimony. The district court said, I'll go ahead.
They weren't available because there wasn't a continuance or something like that?
This had been continued several times previously, and at this point in time, the district court said, we'll hold a hearing. If in the course of the hearing I believe that I need more evidence, right, we'll have a full evidentiary hearing. And that was the context for what went on.
But for example, you say it wasn't reliable, but one of the reports says that the test was adjusted for that, and it didn't place emphasis on her verbal abilities and that they were less culturally laden. So at least the people who did this, I mean, he discounted them because they were frequent people who frequently testify for the defense, but they certainly have very fancy credentials, both of them. So it's really troublesome that he just discounted them because they've testified a lot for defendants in criminal trials. That's why he discounted them. He called them notorious.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that there are also alternate grounds, and that is, in the brief that we filed at that point in time, I went through and looked at the various representations or misrepresentations the appellant had made.
This is why I started where I started, because we're applying an abuse of discretion standard, are we not? And ordinarily, when you do that, you look at the grounds on which the judge exercises discretion. And if at least two of those grounds are highly questionable, one of them being these were notorious defense experts, despite their rather impressive credentials, and another one being what they said was unreliable because of a language problem, even though they purported to take account of it and he didn't have a hearing. Those are both reasons why we might say that he abused his discretion as to those two grounds. Then we see what's left. He did say something about it should have been discovered earlier, and he did say something about it wouldn't have affected the outcome, but I wasn't sure whether that wasn't just another way of saying because they wouldn't have been believed.
Your Honor, I see my time is up, but I'll answer that question as best I can. If you look at the district court's holding, and I understand that he used dicta that I might not have used had I been in his place. But if you look at the holding, what it ultimately comes down to is he was finding that these psychological reports were not reliable and wouldn't have altered the verdict of trial. Now, in light of where we are,
but the reason they couldn't be relied upon was, given the history of these doctors and the inconsistency of their reports with the known conduct of the defendant, their opinions cannot be relied upon.
And I believe the second prong is crucial because you look at the behavior that's demonstrated through the testimony at trial, both by insiders, by victims, and then later on at sentencing, in letters that have been withheld were introduced in which people extol the defendant's wisdom and say they come to her advice, and she's a civic leader, and she's a philanthropist. When you put all that into a bundle, it becomes abundantly clear at this hour that the defendant's demonstrated behaviors do not comport with somebody of a borderline IQ, which the reported cases show should be working at McDonald's under strict supervision, not managing this corporate scheme. What's more, when you look at this item by item, they don't say that she was delusional. You can go through the various representations, and whether her IQ be 80 or 180, she knew that these representations were false. In fact, she says as much in stuff that was submitted to the district court at that point in time. Finally, Your Honor, in light of the concession that the reports were skewed and unreliable because of the English language problem, there'd be no point in a new trial because the reports wouldn't be admissible.
But on that, the reports accounted for that. So that seems to me to be contrary to the record.
I don't believe that is, the report said they accounted for it, but if you actually go through the questions that she was being asked, for example, questions on Hamlet, the Sistine Chapel, things like that, that was included in the test. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason to expect somebody from Taiwan to have that sort of information. But what I'm relying on more is counsel, the appellant's own concession, that she's not retarded.
That may be your strongest point.
Thank you.
You have about 3 minutes left.
What I would ask this court to do, or please the court, is to send us back for a hearing.
On what?
For these psychiatrists to testify and see whether or not the judge would believe what they have to say in live testimony.
But you don't believe it. That's the real problem.
No, that's not true. I do believe it. What I'm saying is she's not retarded. And I don't think they're saying she's really retarded. They give her an IQ of 79. That's not retarded. It's 70 and below.
Okay, so she has an IQ of 79. Now the judge says right. Okay? So where are you now?
I think it goes to her ability to understand and be able to work with the defense in presenting to the jury herself, I think. I think she should have testified so the jury could see what she's really like.
That's an ineffective assistance of counsel.
I understand. That's an issue later. We can't deal with that here now. If I could have, I would have.
At page 11 of Dr. Feister's report, she says, Ms. Flaherty is far from bright, showing general mental functioning in the range between mental retardation and low average mental functioning. Now, you tell us very candidly, and we appreciate your candor today, that you've talked to her and she's not mentally retarded. We suspect that that's probably also what her trial counsel thought, which is why nobody until some attorney between you and the trial counsel thought to get these witnesses. But you tell us she's not mentally retarded, and the doctor tells us that she is borderline retarded.
That may be borderline.
Why would we go back for a hearing?
Well, I think if she were able to testify and have the psychiatrist testify as to what she's like, then have her get up there and the judge could see.
But all this depends on having your client testify, doesn't it?
Yes,
it does. And that bridge has already been crossed.
I understand
that. What you really have to do is get Dr. Feister up here, and Dr.
Yes.
Feister, however you pronounce her name, is going to testify that she's borderline mentally retarded.
That's true, but then we would also put her on the stand on a motion for new trial so the court could see and back up
The court said it had observed her throughout the trial.
Sitting at the table. Your Honor.
And her interaction with her attorney.
Yes, but
and I've heard a lot of testimony about how she'd interacted with others.
There is some, but mostly those that she interacted with were with Chinese background from Taiwan, dealing with her language.
I still don't get it, okay? Mm-hmm. Not everybody's a genius, right?
Including me.
There's a certain level that we say people are retarded, that maybe is something that is relevant. A child or what to go to mental state or to go to, but she's not there. Why is the kind of evidence that, and maybe this evidence, had you had it at the time of trial, would have been admissible. Maybe it would not have been. It's not absolutely clear to me that it would have been. But not everything that would have been admissible at a trial can be a basis for a new trial based on newly discovered evidence. Who she is and what she is and how she functions, of course, was known at trial. The only thing that wasn't known were these reports that some clever lawyer thought herself to get. But even taking them at face value, why is this the kind of evidence that even if we consider it newly discovered is sufficiently significant that we'd say, oh, we need a new trial for this?
Because I think it then presents the picture, the mental state of the defendant the jury.
There's lots of stuff that rounds out the picture. There's lots of things that lawyers say, gosh, I wish I presented this to the jury, you know, I might have had a better result if I presented this or that. But most of that stuff is not, I mean, it's not like all of a sudden discovering, you know, you've got a photograph of her at the time of the crime and she's in the Sistine Chapel with the Pope. You know, that would be good. That would be good. But it's not that kind of thing, right?
No, it's not.
It's something that maybe would have an effect on the jury, or maybe the jury would look at it and say,
I think it would be a totally different...
Isn't that exactly what the district judge did here? The district judge looked at it and said, I'm not impressed. I don't think this is on the level of even believing everything, taking everything at face value. I just don't think this is the kind of stuff that justifies the trial.
I think he went too far. He abused his discretion in not having the witnesses come in to testify and then listening to the defendant on the motion for a new trial.
Yeah, but I don't understand how listening to the defendant on the motion for a new trial has anything to do with anything. The defendant put it, that's not newly discovered evidence.
No, it is not. But yeah. The newly discovered evidence would be after hearing the doctors and then having her on the stand to see how she reacts to questions, to let the court ask her questions. And clearly he would have seen the problems in this case, clearly. Now, there's no doubt we have a 2255, no doubt. I can't do that in a motion for an appeal. I've tried that before and been told otherwise. So clearly that's coming next unless you can give us at least a hearing, maybe it'll avoid the 2255. With that, I would submit unless you have any questions.
Thank you. Case is argued, stand submitted. We are adjourned.